This is Screen Divers. On this week's episode, we are talking about Hail Caesar, directed by Joel Coen and Ethan Coen, written by Joel Coen and Ethan, produced by Joel Coen and Ethan, and starring Josh Brolin, George Clooney, Alden Ehrenreich, Ralph Fiennes, Jonah Hill, Scarlett Johansson, Frances McDormand, Tilda Swinton, Channing Tatum, and a list that keeps going on and on and on and on and on. So many character actors in this, it'll be too long to go through it. The movie's narrated by Michael Gammon. It is the 17th film by the Coen brothers, and it came out in 2016. It has a running time of 106 minutes, produced by Working Title Films and Mike Zoss Productions, and distributed by Universal Pictures. Cinematography by Roger Deakins, edited by Reginald James.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about that later. This movie was made for $22 million, and it made $63 million and change.
Nice.
How are you, Steve?
Hey, I'm great. How about you?
I'm great. How are you?
Great.
At least he didn't use his Bane voice.
Shit, man. How are you, Ricky?
Hey, I'm all good. How's everybody out there?
This was Ricky's pick for our Coen Brothers Month, and I'm glad you picked it, Ricky. I had a hell of a time rewatching this movie. But enough fluffing around. Ricky, what is this movie about?
It's 1951, and the film industry is in transition. The studio system is breaking down, and the Supreme Court ruled that all studios should divest from movie theaters. Then, in the early years, threatened to pull away audiences because of television, and the Cold War and the Red Scares were underway. There's films about films, and there's a studio system, and there's a guy called Eddie Mannix who hates his life, and you spend 30 hours with him.
That's what the movie's about. And we meet a lot of people. I mean, Mannix meets a lot of people. He introduces us to a lot of people in this film
very quickly.
We normally can't talk about a movie before we record the show. So Ricky came up with a word. I call it an embargo, but Ricky has decided to call it an umbargo.
Yeah.
Leave this conversation alone, Umba. We're not talking about it.
Which one?
Everything. Everything,
no, Umba. The conversation before the conversation.
What conversation?
That's the umba go, as in like when you phone us and you go, oh man, you know what I felt about this? It's like, umba, go, we'll talk about this later.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, what's really crazy about this movie is that from the start to the end, it almost feels like five different movies that you experience by the time you see the credits. It's a little bit unhinged in places, but what's really interesting is when you watch it the first time, there is no way you're picking up on everything by the time you get to the end of this film.
And you're bang on, Ricky, spot on. That's a good observation, because I actually found this movie even funnier this time around. There were a lot of... I'll give you an example. There's one sequence where we see... And this is later in the movie, all right? And there's several examples of this, but this is the one that is freshest in my mind. Clooney is shooting the sequence where he meets Jesus for the first time. And... You can see, this happens while Mannix has gone to see the dailies, right? For Hail Caesar. What's the full name of the movie? Hail Caesar. Wait a second. Because I wrote it down. It's in my notes somewhere.
I've got it. Hail Caesar, Tale of Christ.
Yeah.
Tale of Christ.
Yeah, that's important. When Eddie Mannix goes to check the dailies, he's sitting with his secretary. And there's the screen. So we see the camera's behind him, and there's this movie screen. And you can see Clooney just squinting, trying to convey some kind of emotion. And it happens over and over and over again. And you hear the director in the background going, squint, squint against the Granger. And the guy that says that is someone that we just lost. Peter Jason is an actor that looked like Meatloaf a little bit.
Right.
And you may remember Peter Jason because he was a frequent collaborator with John Carpenter. He's in everything.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was in Deadwood as well. fuck. What's up? Wait a second. Oh, this recording, man. Let me just silence everything here. Yeah, and he was in. Don't laugh, because I got fucking. He was in Deadwood as well. Frequent collaborator with John Carpenter, and we just lost him. He was 80 years old, and it's a very familiar face. But it's not just that. There's so much in here. Like even the little details. When we meet Christopher Lambert for the first time, who's the Scandinavian director. Wiki described him as a Scandinavian director, and I had that, but you actually find out exactly where he's from. We find out that he's married, so if he is the father of Diana's character, which is played by Scarlett Johansson, that's why Mannix goes to see him asking about the child. If it is, he's from Malmo, Sweden, and he puts on a decent accent, because Christopher Lambert still has that accent. Yeah. I forgot about the greatness of the sequence with Ralph Fiennes.
And Hobie.
It's perfect. Absolutely perfect.
Because his name is Lawrence.
Lawrence.
Right? Yeah. So at the beginning, he's insisting upon Hobie calling him by his surname.
Yeah.
Because he's a great director, right? But then it's out of exasperation, that border is completely crossed when he goes, no, you can call me Lawrence.
Call me Lawrence.
Now we're going to fight. What is it that he's asking for? A mirthless chuckle.
Mirthless chuckle, yeah, and the classic.
Would that it were so were souls.
I just love the fact that when you get to the daily cut, and it's like, it's complicated.
Yeah. You were talking about the daily cut. I completely forgot there was Frances McDormand, man.
Yeah,
the choking sequence. You know, she's a film cutter, and. One of the things that I really wanted to discuss with you guys before we recorded today, but we had this self-imposed embargo, so we couldn't talk about it, was how, yes, I picked up on the general subtext of the fact that all these characters are based upon real protagonists of the golden era of Hollywood. Yeah. And also, but I didn't, like doing the research, I came across, and then, obviously, as I'm watching the movie, I'm going, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah. And it all came flooding back because I actually love all those movies, particularly between the 50s and the 60s. The golden era of Hollywood ranged from the 1920s to the 60s. But this movie also, it's so kind of, there's foreshadowing in this, and we talk about that later as well. I think there's foreshadowing because this one line by Mannix, I think one of the lines by Mannix when he's going to the confessional, and he says, I slapped a movie star in anger. Yeah. And I just pictured Will Smith in that moment. Not only that, but also there's a lot of meta things that happen in this film. Like one of them, the movie opens with him in the confessional and he's talking about he's lying to himself and to his wife about smoking, right? Because he says, I slept a couple. But then later on, we work out that he's smoking all the time.
Yeah.
And so he's not only lying to pretty much everyone around him, but he's lying to us. And there's a moment right after his wife, when we meet her, which, by the way, Ricky, this is, you know, someone that you may have noticed, but is it Alison?
Pill.
Alison Pill from one of your favorites, Ricky. And Steve, it was one of your favorites as well, which is Scott Pilgrim.
Yeah,
but not only she was that, a drummer, right? She's prolific nowadays. So she was also in a HBO show called Newsnight,
also in Trap. That was absolute dog shit. Yeah, but
but Newsnight was Aaron Sorkin. So
better, much better.
And she was in Star Trek Picard as well.
Oh, she's in that as well. Yeah, right. Yeah. She was. And in that sequence, he's reluctantly lying to his wife as well, because she asks, "How's it going? How are you doing? Like with the smoking?" And he goes, "Well, you know." But you can see there's a shame and regret in his face. And then the next frame that we see is him driving and smoking. So, but that's when it's revealed that he was lying to us as well, because it's not clean cut that he's, you know, for all we know, because he refuses. First, he asks for a cigarette and doesn't take it in the opening of the movie. And then later on, when he goes to see the Lockheed guy as well, he's offered the cigarette. He says, no, thank you. Hmm. What it means is, I have my own, thank you. I'm not going to smoke in front of you because it's something that he does in secret. Hmm. So,
It's also, I love films that are a day in the life of. So good examples of that would be Dazed and Confused.
Yeah.
Go is another film that does that. Mm-hmm. And this film does exactly that. It is pretty much one solid day in the life of Eddie Mannix. And one of the things that you really feel in it is that if he was trying to be good at the start of the movie, the circumstances that he gets completely confronted by moment by moment makes him back into the thing that he can't be the good person anymore. He has to be the person who's with the iron fist, pun intended, to like draw everybody back into line.
Absolutely. So we have George Clooney playing Bird Whitlock, and you know, typical movie star. Allegedly, he was modeled after Robert Taylor, and this is solely on the fact that if you look at Robert Taylor's repertoire of movies, they're all like ancient Rome kind of thing, and it was a popular, you know, between 1940, let's say 1947, 1948, and all the way through the 1960s. This was a way, but they're the equivalent to westerns. Besides Spartacus, every and Quo Vadis, maybe these every other movie kind of straddled that line of, you know, we're going to make a few bucks, but it wasn't, it was a genre that was dying. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
And also it was profitable to make them because they have wardrobe from other movies that kept being reused and reused. Mm-hmm. All the assets were reused. So, you know, all you needed was a lot of extras back then, pretty much. But, so Robert Taylor, there's another actor that I thought George Clooney was channeling here, and it's Tony Curtis. I don't know why. Like, yeah. I don't know. There's something. Because he's funny. George Clooney is really funny as a bumbling fool here. And Ricky, you said it in another episode. You said that these movies are populated by, you know, characters that come across as being bumbling fools. And he's the one here, right?
Yeah, it's quite hard not to pick a bumbling fool in this movie. Apart from Eddie Mannix, because Eddie Mannix is the only one who's solving problems. Everybody else is creating problems and consistently creating problems over and over again.
Let's just say that Hobie Doyle is also a partial fixer in this movie.
He is. It's a surprise as well when it happens, right?
Yeah.
Because it's the one about the extras, when he tells him about the extras.
But it's not just that. It's later when he sees the suitcase and he knows exactly what's going on.
Yeah,
so, yeah, and he's the one who gets Whitlock out of this.
He ditches a date altogether because that was run really well, right?
But the one you think is the you know, the one who's a little bit special, let's just say that, maybe a little bit dumb, is the guy who actually is more switched on than most of them.
Mm.
So it's nice to actually see that happen during this movie.
Okay, due to this, we're going to throw out the window any attempt to do this chronologically. So,
of course, yeah, because it's not really worth it because there's so many threads in this movie.
Yeah,
which are
it's not worth it. Even if it was the plan I had, fuck it, it's not worth it. Right, we're not going to do that. But
no, it's a plan.
I'll tell you what, Steve.
We had a completely different plan.
No, different plan. Yeah, different plan. They're never going to find you, dude. They're never going to find you. I'm not even telling Ricky where I buried you. What's going to happen now is I'm going to give you something. Okay? I'm going to give it to you now, Steve. Because I don't, maybe, you know, like, I don't want to play that game where, oh, you stole my factoid. No, I'm going to give it to you. So I'm going to ask you a question. Get out of the way now.
Okay.
When the submarine emerges, who is the actor that plays the Russian that comes out of the submarine?
Dolph Lundgren.
There you go. You're happy, Steve? There you go. Well done, Steve.
Come on. In shadow.
This is going to be like the 38 special, Ricky. Like when he was fucking ready with that gun, right?
Pick me.
Hey, just because I memorized some stuff in my head.
Of course.
Yeah.
So, look, everyone here really, really shines. Okay. It's the only one, or the only one actor here that was kind of, because everyone else I thought that was, you know, even the lines that were given, even if it was a couple, like, what's it, David Crummels? Is that his name? He's one of the communists in the background. It's like, the boss is parasite.
Who's that? when do we get paid?
Yeah, he has two lines, right?
Yeah, he's got two lines. One of them is, the boss is parasitic. And the other one's like, the boss is parasitic. It's great. And Fisher Stevens, dude. Fisher Stevens is in this.
Brilliant. Like, he is so good in this. He is so spot on.
That cast was casted an impossible role in the 80s. Didn't he play? Wasn't he meant to play like an Indian?
He did. He played Short Circuit, yeah.
Yeah.
He's not, dude.
No. He's not. Very Jewish. Jewish actor. Very Jewish.
We always talk about that Short Circuit situation where it's just so bad, it's not good.
It's as bad as Soul Man. We're going to have to do Soul Man at some point, dude. Soul Man is just, modern standards. Actually, by modern standards, it may just get remade at the moment.
Yeah, I was going to say that Fisher Stevens' performance in Short Circuit is akin to Robert Downey Jr.'s performance in Tropic Thunder, but without any of the mirth or the tongue-in-cheekness.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Wasn't Fisher Stevens the villain in
Hackers?
Yes, he was. Yes, he was. Jesus,
mate, we can do a Fisher Stevens season. I'm up for that.
We're gonna have to.
God.
Hey, you know what? I was gonna open this episode going, this movie came out in 1984, and you guys going, what are you talking about? I'm gonna start talking about the Anthony Michael Hall. Hail Caesar?
Yeah.
Oh, God, yeah. When you, sent that, I was like, that's the Hail Caesar we should be doing.
Or you could have answered that, when I went, what's this movie about? And just tell us the plot line of that movie.
Yeah, the plot of that one. This guy is trying to get into the music industry.
You know why? Me and Steve were talking about Anthony Michael Hall just the other day, because he's in season 3 of Reacher.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
I didn't know that, no.
Yeah,
I'm not on that show.
Yeah, that show makes me gay. The more I watch the show, the gayer I get as I watch Richard.
Boomer just wants him to be the next Batman.
Wait,
I want him to be the next Batman. It's also, you know, it's also like if I ever get, because I'm paying every month, I'm paying for the gym, right? So every time I fucking see this guy, I'm thinking, maybe I should go to the gym. Then he takes his shirt off and I go, fuck that. I'm just not, you know, that's unattainable, mate. I'm never going to be that big. It's just never going to happen. I'm going to be that big, but not shaped like that. You know what I mean? It's whatever. Anyway.
We're not
gay for richer. That's what this is. Yeah.
I mean,
rich and gay.
I mean, you're finding another man attractive. It's okay, Umbar.
Nah.
We live in the 21st century. It's okay. You're all right. Yeah.
Unless you live in the States.
Don't tell your priest on the weekend, but you're okay.
The priest will turn around and go, yeah, are you watching Richard as well?
about priests, that scene with all the religious leaders, including...
I was going to do that
perfect.
I was going to install this one from me to talk about it, because Robert Picardo looking at his watch... Mate, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I was going to talk about Robert Picardo. Robert Picardo. And we've just talked about him in The Burbs. Go listen to that episode.
Robert
Picardo as the rabbi, every line that comes out of his mouth is gold.
It's perfect.
One of them says, God has children. And he says, what? And a dog? A collie, maybe? God doesn't have children. He's a bachelor. And he's very angry. I love it.
Is he Jewish?
Jewish? That's an old God.
You don't think he's Jewish? Really?
Maybe not. No.
Okay.
And it would be kind of funny. It would be kind of funny if he got, you know.
Because he played it really well. But I'll go on a deep dive and just have a look.
Okay. Tap, tap, tap.
Oh, Voyager.
I love the orthodox priest, because his problem with the movie was, you're kind of even jumping from one chariot to the other. Like, no, what the fuck? Man, that entire sequence.
We'll take it off on.
Absolutely. But it's just, Robert Picardo looking at his watch towards the end of that sequence. When the priest is going on about the Son of God, he's just going, oh, fuck this. It's just absolutely great.
I just love how he just keeps going, like, about God's angry. I mean, what are you guys talking about? There's no such thing. And we do not see him as a Messiah, but as a godlike figure, why not?
It's a great sequence.
The Protestant clergyman just turns around and goes, you worship the God of another age. It's like oh my God.
You know.
Who has no love.
In that sequence in particular.
He likes cheese.
Yeah. In that sequence in particular, and Steve, you brought up, before we started recording, you brought up Roger Deakins as a cinematographer in this.
Yeah.
You know, he's got a phenomenal body of work. This guy's worked with Villeneuve, has worked with Sam Mendes. He's fantastic, but he doesn't mess around with quirky. He doesn't. And this movie kind of I almost felt like it lacked that, but I don't know if the Coen brothers wanted to go in that direction completely. Because there are a lot of sequences where the funny would have been turned to 11 if there was the use of a wider kind of quirkier wide angle lens, and it would have worked really well in that sequence because the camera is on the table and the shot keeps going from Mannix talking to them to their response, and you could have had this kind of unhinged look to it because it's a crazy conversation. It's a crazy idea that you would have had four religious leaders to release a blockbuster of the time, you know, but they didn't do it. And I think the reason why they didn't do it is because they didn't want to. The movie is more satirical than a parody, in my opinion. And they were probably paying homage to the golden era of Hollywood as well. Yeah. They were taking the pace a little bit, but it's more satirical. It's not there's no ridicule. There's no ridicule over these characters. It's more like a satirical take. And let's talk about Tilda, because I had to look this up and I didn't get it on the first viewing. Tilda Swinton, just like the rest of them, and we're gonna talk about what they're modeled after, right? We talked about George Clooney being a take on Robert Taylor, in my opinion, Tony Curtis as well. But then, do you know that Tilda Swinton is playing two twins in this, obviously? Mm-hmm. One of them was a columnist that wrote mainly opinion pieces, and the other one was also a columnist, but she was more like of a tabloid journalist.
Yeah.
So, and they were completely competing all the way through their relationship because they were identical twin sisters as well. And it kind of, there's a little bit of tongue in cheek in this movie in every sequence if you pay attention. And one of them in particular I didn't pick up on the first viewing, which is when he meets her the first time, when he meets Thora. What are their names, guys? Do you remember the name of the, it's Thora Thacker and Thessaly Thacker. They were modeled after Hedda Hopper and Luella Parsons.
Yes.
Now, in the sequence where Mannix meets Thora and Thessaly, that's what they're called here, he speaks to Thora first. And at the end of that interlude, which is hilarious, she goes, I have 90 million readers, you know. Shortly after that, he meets Thessaly. He has another funny exchange with her. And and she's the gossip writer, right? Right before Mannix walks away, she goes, I have 20 million, which means that she was listening. She was eavesdropping the previous conversation. And being a gossip writer, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
So Hedda Hopper was one of the lead journalists who was trying to make Charlie Chaplin out to be a socialist during that time, and hence anti-American.
That is correct. And that's what this movie's touching on as well. He throws her off the scent towards the end because the situation's resolved, but just because he didn't want smears of any kind touching the studio. So Mannix is doing his job correctly. Yeah. And it's the dialogue's great in this. It's really, really good. But before we continue down the list of this, they're more than cameos. You know, everyone featuring in this vignettes is doing an excellent job.
Do you want to hear about the religion of Robert Picardo?
Yeah.
While I say the name Robert Alphonse Picardo, what do you think his religion is, or what his background
Christian,
is?
It's Catholic.
He's Italian.
You're joking?
He's Italian. No, his Italian heritage.
Hey! am a supplier. Hey,
of course he's got one. There we go.
Okay. So he's Catholic, right?
Yeah, of course he's Catholic.
Which is great to have given him, because they're Jewish.
I apologize, anybody who's listening to us, 20, 25 of us. Yes, he is not Jewish.
Okay. All right. So, in regards to everyone kind of shining through this, I thought that the one that was robbed a little bit, because I'm a huge fan of, is Wayne Knight. Wayne Knight plays the poisoner in this.
Yes.
And is widely underused in this. Like, it's even in the little bit that he does, because his entire bit when he gets hit with the Claudius in the face.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, that prop hits back later. Like that, Italicus, by the way. Italicus. Did you know that George Clooney's character in the movie that they're shooting, his name is Italicus? Just
so,
the name of the Roman Praetorian, whatever. And the other guy next to him, which is Clancy Brown, his name is Crocus. It's Crocus and Italicus. But Italicus Gladius hits twice as a prop in this.
Yeah,
It's a small thing that happens, but when he's being abducted by the future, by the way, the communist group, I think it's called the future or something. When he sits down on the chair, you can see that this thing is not designed to be sitting down, and it's just fumbling with this Praetorian Gladius, and it's funny. But the first time he literally turns around and he hits Wayne Knight in the face, and it kind of stops him from chuckling when this happens. And what they're chuckling about is an entire bit about Palestine, which we're not going to touch. But we're not going to touch it.
No.
But do you remember that?
Yeah.
They're talking about Palestine and all of a sudden everyone's laughing. But some people are not laughing.
Yeah.
And that's, I love that as well, because there's duality. Like it's.
Yeah. Didn't you find, though, as Wayne Knight was pouring whatever he was pouring into the cup.
A lot of it.
That you just wanted to constantly say, Newman. Over and over
again. You control the mail. Yeah. You control information.
Newman.
Newman. He's great. He's great in that. He was great in Seinfeld, but he was also great in That Rock from the Sun.
Yeah.
He plays the cop in that.
Oh, yeah.
It's
just
memorable.
He's and when he, even when he does smaller roles in family films, like he was in Cheaper by the Dozen, he fulfills
Jurassic
that role.
Park, dude.
Jurassic Park.
Yeah, like, of course. But like he fulfills roles just, and he might be on the screen like he was on this one for like 5 minutes and he's there. Another person who takes a very small time, but was all over the poster or all over the advertisement was Jonah Hill.
Yeah.
And he's only on 3 minutes of the film.
Yeah, he's bonded. I'm bonded, man. He plays the surety agent. I had to look what that is. And it was a real thing. Like it is a, maybe by today's standards as well, it is a real thing. It's a legal role you can take in many different situations. But it's a surety agent?
Yeah, it's kind of close to like what Mannix does, but it's more of the legal side. So, for example, they say in that scene, oh, he's a notary as well, about the adoption papers, and that he could just do them without it going through a court or anything like that. So,
I was a little bit disappointed because it is around the time, maybe a year before or a year after, I can't remember, it's around the time in which he was in the Wolf of Wall Street, and he burns the screen when he's on that. In that, he's just phenomenal. So I would have expected him to get a little bit more screen time, but it's a very small role. And that's okay. We get a lot of his buddy, though, Channing Tatum. His name is Jeff.
Yeah.
We get a lot of him. And, man, he is modeled after Gene Kelly. So let's talk about him a little bit.
Oh, mate, his sequence is amazing.
It is.
It's so...
It is.
Yeah.
What's the name of the song that they're doing? Oh.
No Dames, isn't it?
No Dames.
No Dames.
No Dames.
And I love how that entire sequence ends with
the two guys basically
being sandwiched in between two dudes. And that's what the bartender at the back of the girl is. Hey, this is not that kind of bar.
Background. The whole sequence, it's though,
super
is
super gay. Yeah,
yeah, no, but the whole sequence itself, like, there's a point where
The choreography is outstanding.
Oh, but even the verbiage when he's like, "Oh, we're shipping out in the morning. Golly, 8 months without a dame. Can you beat it?" And then the bartender goes, "You're gonna have to beat it." That could mean so many things. And in that moment, you see Channing Tatum look up to the camera with like a. Maybe.
It's a one double entendre after another. Yeah. And also the bartender's pulling the tablecloths from under their feet. That's well choreographed, dude, the entire sequence.
It's and not just even, that, it's the bottles as well.
But when the doors open and they're... most of the dancers are in a 69 position and the sailors are just waiting and then they go, "Looks like they're open, boys," and then comes
super gay. It's super gay. And Al is like loaded with makeup when he's not, he's got more makeup when he's not on camera than he's when he, dude, when he's dog with the little terrier, when he's at the front of that dinghy as they are going towards the submarine.
It's just... and the weird, like, likening to Washington crossing the
Delaware.
Washington crossing the Delaware, that painting. Yeah. Mm. Oh. And they're doing all of that, and they have that weird comic interlude of, like, "Here, take the money. And give it to the cause, give it to the party," and he drops it.
You know, we talked about Wayne Knight being underused, underutilizing this, and there was also another, which is an actor that I find hilarious. The problem is that I never get enough of him every time I see him on screen. His name is Fred Melamed. I don't know if you know who he is. He's one of the communists. He's got a beard and glasses.
Yeah.
Mm. He's hilarious. He reminds me, I put him with in the same box, and that's a good thing, as Tobolowsky. If you know Tobolowsky. Yeah, he's the same type of actor. But he plays this kind of very neurotic, high-energy kind of character as a big, heavy-set man with a beard. Yeah. He's always like an advisor of some kind in movies, or a lawyer or something like that. I mean, he's Jewish and he plays a lawyer. Or an accountant. If we're going to go there.
He was in Barry, wasn't he?
He's memorable every time, but he barely has any lines in this. I love how hilarious the process of indoctrination for Baird is. Because when he returns, after he just walks out of this ransom situation, basically, when Hobie goes to get him, he goes, "I'm taking you back."
I love that little comment where it's just, "Hobie, are you communist too?"
He's just found out this new ideology. And I love when he's sitting on the chair and he goes... to Mannix, he goes, "They have this book, it's called The Capital, but with a K." And you see that while he keeps talking, Mannix stands up, walks around the desk, and then just grabs him and literally slaps the communism out of him. You just see this look of confusion, and that's it. That's the end of the ideology, and he just walks out. It's great.
I also love the line where he's sitting there with the communists, and he goes, "Oh, yeah, because I'm thinking, who benefits?" And he does that story about Danny Kaye, who was in a lot of Bing Crosby films as well as his own films. And the whole story about the razor and like shaving Danny Kaye's back. And he says it's for a Norman Taurog picture. And then he gets told later on that there is no Norman Taurog picture. He just wants you to shave his back. But so who's benefits? See
how he's appealing to the politeness of the professor that in front of him. How he's just trying to follow his fucking story. And he's got this puzzled look on his face. It's really, really, really funny.
One thing I'm going to mention as well, just the sheer fact that George Clooney is in that outfit the entire movie.
He is. Yeah. You're right. It's
great.
He's so funny in this, man. He's got comedic chops. We talked about him before. I think he cut his teeth on Roseanne. You know, I think it was Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. That was one of, am I wrong? It was one of the first
Attack
movies, probably.
Attack of the Killer Tomatoes was his first feature,
Yeah, but then his big break was on Roseanne, and then after that, he went to go on one of the shows that you watch, Ricky, ER or some shit like that. Was it ER?
Yeah, it was ego.
Well, I need to stop watching.
Maybe you should. Maybe you should watch it.
Just maybe
I'm putting the seed in there because, like, in about 4 years' time, I will get a text message.
Where
from
are you putting
saying,
the seed? Which orifice?
I don't know, but like, God. I'll put the seed in there, and he's going to watch it in 4 or 5 years' time and be like, "Dude, did you know about this ER?"
Jesus Christ. Scarlett Johansson is also very fun in this, but yeah. she did remind me of Debbie Mazar.
Yeah,
everything about her in the way she's talking, the way she's acting. I wonder if that's how she walked onto the set. Just, I'm going to do a Debbie Mazar. Because if you close your eyes, that's what you hear.
Yeah, but it is also very close to Lucille Ball as well. Like, Lucille Ball off camera had that accent too. And it's...
Well, wait a second. Her character, though, was, again, because we're talking about the real movie stars, that it's you know, these characters are a take on. She's modeled after Esther Williams. Now... Mm. If you look at her demeanor in this movie, she's had enough. You know, she's got by this stage in her career, which is, again, the beginning of the 60s, the end of the 50s, so it's the fall of the golden age or whatever you want to call of Hollywood, but she's chain smoking. She's she's disgruntled. She's dealing with two failed marriages or whatever. And she comes across as a golding about it. Not really. It's just like, I fucking had enough of this. But they had enough of this is because Esther Williams, if you look at her career, she's always in a bikini. It's always like the mermaid. And that's it. That's her career. The majority of the movies. So you would be like, I think it's one of the peak examples of being typecasted in something.
Do you want a factoid for Esther Williams?
Please.
So The Million Dollar Mermaid was made in 1952, which had the amazing dive from, just like in this movie, dive from the top of
a beautiful
lift
sequence. Yep.
Into the... Yeah, she broke her neck on that 115-foot dive.
Oh, wow. Well, there you go.
She survived, but she broke her neck on it.
Jeez, yeah. Well, that's the attitude that Scarlett Johansson has in this. It's like, come on. she's done. I don't know why it's on me now. Come on, I had an hour for bikini movies. I want to
give me the cigarette. I know that I'm pregnant, but it's okay.
There is no mermaid.
1950 is acceptable.
I don't know what to do with this child. I think I know who the father is. Yeah, I know who the father is.
Maybe.
Well, there's a joke though, or someone that's fucking doing AI, like is putting on his face on everything.
Yeah,
she just Black Widow. Anyway, and then what else? I mean, it's Hobie. Let's talk about Hobie a little bit because
Aiden. Yeah,
yeah, he's great in this, and I just cannot. It's 3 years prior to, although this movie was in development since 2013. But still was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And I kept thinking of DiCaprio's character.
Yeah.
Like every time Hobie's on screen. And, you know, like you think he's a bumbling fool. And like Steve said earlier, he's the one actually that gives a lot of insight to Mannix at one point. The entire thing about the extras, like, never know what they're thinking. You know, you never know what an extra's thinking. But the funniest, the sequence that Ralph finds is immortal. It's hilarious.
It's fantastic.
Yeah,
I struggle to watch it because it's so awkward.
But it's funny. It's really, really funny. And Ralph, man, I met Ralph Fiennes. Just me and him in a room for like an hour. He's a gentleman. He's taller than you think. And I was the catering manager at RADA here in London. He was organizing a function for his second directorial debut, or his first actually, which was Coriolanus.
Yeah,
and he wanted to work through the menus, so we're sitting together, and
lovely.
I was starstruck only for the first 5 minutes, and then that's it. But he is amazing, and he's much more like he looks like a gentleman. You got to understand that this is a point of his career where I remembered him the most as the Nazi in Schindler's List.
Yes,
so there was quite a lot of contrast between the. You know what I mean? Yeah. But anyway, yeah, that's I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan. He beefed up now. I don't know how old he is, but there's shots of him online. Like he must be pushing 60, right? Mm. Easy.
Yeah, easily.
Have you seen what he did?
I saw one photo which popped up on Facebook recently.
Yeah, that's the key, right? Because at that age, you don't beef up like that. No. You don't. No matter if you have a personal trainer or not, that's TRT. Which is, no, it's all right, but it's testosterone for sure.
I haven't seen Conclave yet, but the last things I've seen...
I've got it on my drive.
Yeah, the last thing that I've seen is a wonderful story. You know, the Henry, the Roald Dahl series on Netflix, which included lots of different stories.
Mm-hmm.
But we were talking about Alden... And I'm going to butcher his name because I keep reading his name and I keep saying it in like several different ways. But Alden Ehrenreich?
Ehrenreich? Yeah, I think I butchered it as well. So
yeah. I actually
Alden.
I knew of him earlier because of his work with Francis Ford Coppola. So he was in the movie Tetro. And I've mentioned Tetro before, but Tetro is a very interesting film where he plays one of the leads, and the other person, the other lead is Vincent Gallo, and they're estranged brothers. It's a very intense film, but he did several other films, including Stoker, and this was his first one.
That's
where,
one of my favorite films. I don't remember him in Stoker.
Oh, yeah. You know, he's like one of the minor characters that comes visit the house on a regular basis, like who tries to befriend... the main girl, who I also butcher her name.
That's a phenomenal
Mia
movie.
Mia Wasikowska.
Okay. Yeah.
I always say Mia Wasikowska.
That's a phenomenal film that we highly recommend to everybody. Yep. If you haven't seen Stoker, watch it.
After Hail Caesar, he did do a run of films, including...
Yes. Well, Solo, the Star Wars movie.
Yeah. There we go.
He did a good job, man. He did a good job.
Yeah, in comparison to what he did, like, he is a versatile actor. So, Steve, tell me what you think about our new Han Solo. Well, actually, he's only done one Han Solo, and he'll probably
won't
do it again.
He's only done one so far.
Yeah.
He plays a good Han Solo, although I believe there was a different actor I would have gone with. But,
who?
The guy who'd already played a young Harrison Ford. In another movie.
Well, wait a second. Wasn't there a series as well?
Yeah.
For Indiana Jones? It was a TV series.
But that was a long
time ago.
Yeah,
it was a long time ago.
Yeah. But,
a long time ago.
A long time. In a galaxy far, far away.
It was like the fucking 90s or something.
Yeah.
I can still remember.
Oh, my.
A long time ago. I can still remember how that music used to make me smile. And I knew if I had my chance that I could make those people dance and maybe they'd be happy for a while. But February made me shiver.
God.
So,
how many tabs you got open, Steve?
I've got five.
Okay.
I'm about to create a new one because I've got to remember this. But there was a guy, but the same guy who'd played the young... a young version of Harrison Ford in another movie about a war. I think there was a horse involved, but I can't remember exactly. But he did a YouTube
War Horse
piece. It wasn't War Horse.
You said a movie about a horse.
Yeah,
was there a movie called War Horse?
Yes,
there
was a movie called War Horse. It's also a play as well. Yeah.
Okay. It's not that one.
No, but it was basically... This is going back too far, and I don't have the information readily available. But there's a
YouTube
sketch.
You mentioned all of this, by the way. This entire thread.
No. It was my fault.
It was you. But
I
then
wasn't
he
prepared
mentioned
for this.
This actor.
Yeah, I know, and I'm trying to find it. So,
okay. Well, once you come up with it, we throw it in there.
Drop it in, like I did.
John Polito.
John Polito.
Was it John Polito? You played a great
Han
Solo. Okay, so...
So, one scene I want to talk about, and I'm sure we're going to be... It's going to come back to that, is it's a really small scene, but it's a brilliant one. It's one of the final scenes on when they're about to film the part where... George Clooney's character, as the character in the Roman film, is about to meet Jesus. And the runner just goes, are you principal or supporting cast?
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like, I don't know. Well, look, if you're principal, you get this lunch, and if you're supporting, you just get this lunch. I think I'm principal.
Principal? Yeah. But he asks him something before that. He's like, what's your name? He's on the cross. He goes, Todd. There's a lot of little bits in this movie. If you pay attention, the fun is there. The fun is right there between the lines, and I missed out on it the first time around. Even the way Frances McDormand is choking.
Oh, that's such so a genius. Weird.
Yeah, because he's looking at her, not like I'm going to let you die, but she could have died because he's so surprised by what's happening. He's trying to compute. Mannix is trying to compute what the fuck is going on here, and then helps her. But he has a moment of, like, he freezes. It's like a fight or flight situation, and there's a moment in which, because it comes out of nowhere. And actually, that scene is even funnier. When you, for a moment, I thought, oh no, because she's in charge of the dailies, right? And when this happens, a cigarette burns the bit on the divan. So I thought, oh no, they're going to have to reshoot the entire thing. And that was funny to me.
But also, the way it's set up and the way it's written, the fact is, you know that the line, I've forgotten the line again.
She's also modeled after a very famous female editor, by the way.
Yeah, and the line that we all love, which is, would it that it was so simple? Would it have was something simple? Would it have was so simple? We've already been prepped as an audience to know that that line is coming, and it's coming so hard, and it's getting more and more intense. Watch it, and you just want to know what his reaction's going to be to "would it were so simple," or is it going to be "would it were so simple"? Which one is it going to be? And it stops. Everything stops, and then you have that weird choking incident, and you're like, "Oh my god, this is a new." And then nothing happens. Like, he just flips it in reverse, and she doesn't die, and she's like, "Oh, my scarf," and all that stuff. And then they play it, and of course, Steve said it earlier. He just says, it's complicated. And that's it. It's
but she also doesn't miss comedy. A beat, dude, because she had this happening before several times. It's like, it seems to me that this was a thing that was happening to people. This is a, maybe that's a thing that you would recommend them not to do, to wear clothing that would get jammed in, because that's, you know, you'll die. You would die in a stupid and horrible way.
Okay, so I'm just going to say this now before I forget. It's Anthony Ingruber. who did a Harrison Ford impression, but he also played a younger Harrison Ford in for Solo, and it was spot on. It was the most perfect version of
What's his name?
Anthony Ingruber.
He does look very much.
You are right. And what was it?
So Gruber played a younger version of Indiana Jones.
He was an Australian actor, but minor. Young, like, like, he was in Avalon High, which is a Disney made-for-TV film, and Age of Adeline as well. But yeah, he got he to do it, didn't he, Steve?
He
got to be a young Harrison.
Yeah, and it's absolutely perfect. Him doing Solo was amazing. I don't know whether he actually did a screen test or anything like that, but it's absolutely perfect.
Once again, where did he get to play a young Harrison Ford?
Anthony Ingruber, versions of Anthony Ingruber. Ingruber played a younger version of Indiana Jones in the opening sequence of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. That's wrong.
That is wrong.
That's wrong. That's Phoenix. That's what.
That was Google. That was Phoenix, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was Phoenix.
River Phoenix got to play.
So, what is the thing that he got to play? Because I remember the entire debacle about him not getting the role.
A younger version of Harrison Ford's character in a film, The Age of Adeline, in 2000.
Oh, there you go. It was Age of Adeline.
Age of Adeline.
Yeah.
Okay. So that was.
I don't think I've seen it.
Oh, have you not? It's okay. But it's rom-commy. It's okay, but it's rom-com.
Guys, there's, you know, we could go on and on and on and on and on, but we won't. There is a bit about the Italian origami at the table. Now, when Hobie goes to pick up Carlotta, because they're going to the premiere of Hobie's movie, There is a sequence when they're outside, he comes out of the limo, the driver's outside as well waiting, and there's a likable, charming quality about Hobie's character because he's nice to everybody on set. You know, yeah. Like he's still at that point of his career where, you know, plus he's got that southern thing about him, is so he treats everyone like an equal. And at one point, as he's waiting by the car, he starts this lasso play thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw his lasso work. That's actually him.
Mm.
And that's no easy feat, dude. You need to learn that
shit. That's a lot of training.
And when I saw that, I remember a story by, I think it was Steve Martin. And if you, that performance is akin to what you see Steve Martin do in The Three Amigos.
Yeah.
In The Three Amigos, Steve Martin shows some real lasso work. And I saw an interview with him when he was talking about lasso work is one of the things that you had to learn if you had a little job at Disneyland. You know that job where people entertain the crowd, the tourists? Oh, yeah. Well, lasso work is one of the things that you need to learn. So I'm wondering where he picked, I don't know, maybe just that training for this part, but that's pretty impressive, the entire thing he does. And then to do it with some spaghetti as well, that means, you know.
So in a few interviews, this was like with Channing Tatum. Channing Tatum was a dancer beforehand, but he had never done tap. So same thing with Alden. They both got asked, could you pick up a few things? And so they went off, and that part of the pre-production was them learning how to do some of these things.
Very
Alden
nice.
Said the hardest thing was using spaghetti. That was the most difficult. Using a rope was easier, but using spaghetti, oh my goodness, he said.
You can see that they're not real spaghetti. Like it's like some kind of, but it looks like that, so that's fine. I think it's time for ratings. What do you think?
Yep.
Who wants to go first?
I can go first. This is a solid 8 out of 10 lassos for me. I mean, it's beautifully crafted on 35mm film. It's actually not a digital film because they wanted to basically go back to the golden age and show that kind of respect as well, which is admirable in this day and age because obviously film is so expensive in comparison to digital kind of situations. And it really does capture it in the picture. I mean, this is only my second watch. And I think it's a more solid movie on my second watch. Mm. I would have rated it a 6 on my previous watch, but this time it's definitely got jumped up.
So it's gone up in your estimation.
It's gone up, definitely.
Mm. I have a similar experience, yeah. Ricky?
According to Jimbo 53186511, the Coen brothers hit a new low. Well edited, acting is excellent. The Coen brothers really couldn't have assembled a better cast. It's a shame that their writing is so weak, which isn't a 1 out of 10, but anyway.
Can you can you reply to this fucking people on IMDb? can you reply instead of waiting to reply, or you can just upvote or downvote?
Yeah, you
can
up and downvote it, but I'm these guys, hilarious.
Did you shower today? Did you get a job? Have you got a job?
I just found
How's your mom, dude? Is she upstairs?
I found it more hilarious that he said that it's a technical success, well edited, acting's excellent. He's written 4 or 5 really good points about it and then given it a 1. Anyway.
What the hell?
Hated it. What's his name? What's his username?
Jimbo 53186511, February 10th, 2017. Thank
Can
you.
Can I just say that when you make your fucking username, if it gets to the point in which 11,000 people before you speak Jimbo, just pick a different username. You know what I mean? Like, if it's your username and your date of birth is taken, move on. Just fucking riff over something else about you and make that your username. How many fucking Jimbos? There's an army of Jimbos out there. They're clones, dude.
I just love that it's 53-186511. So there's more Jimbo 53s.
And this is topical. For all you know, that's going to be the model number of the army of robots. There was an article about another one of the insane ramblings from Elon Musk about
robots.
Mate, yeah. He said that by 2027, he will have an army of military robots or some shit. They're going to be called Jimbo. What's the model number? What is it?
53-18-6511.
Yep. Holy shit.
Right, my real rating. Yes. My real rating. I actually
How many Jimbos, dude?
I was really actually worried about doing this episode with you guys because this time when I watched it, I felt like the ending really let it down for me. And I was a little bit like, oh, am I going to watch this again? Of course I'm going to watch it again. There's too many, like, would it be good? And there were so many little scenes that are amazing in it. But then the ending of it didn't seem to cap everything together very well. So I was like,
it's very little closure. Very little closure.
Yeah. So I was like, should it be a high 6? Should it be a low 7? But through this conversation and revisiting it away from the film has made me actually go, you know what? No. This film deserves not only a rewatch, but a passing on to people. I'm going to give it 7.9 Dolph Lundgren's on a submarine.
That's very nice. Well, before I get into it, I'll keep it nice and short, but there is a final sequence that usually could have been the closer for this movie. Instead of the crane shot of Hollywood, I get it, you know, and then towards the sky with the behold on the water tower.
Yeah.
It's the sequence in which there's a monologue by Italicus. There's a little bit of back and forth between Italicus and Crackus. This is basically the pivotal sequence of the movie they're shooting, which is Hail Caesar, Tale of Christ.
Which is based on Ben-Hur.
That's two of the movies that we mentioned at the beginning of this episode were Bovadis and Spartacus. But Ben-Hur as well was, you know, in a classic.
Yeah.
And there is a moment in which there's a beautiful, beautiful monologue that this is meant to be touching. It's meant to be the moment that the viewer is being reached by the performance. And you know this because you see the reaction of the crew. You see the reaction of the crew starts tearing up. And it's kind of comical so that you don't feel that way, but you're still following. And then all of a sudden, at the climax point, the climatic point of this entire thing, he forgets one word. Yep. It's the closer. And the word was faith. So I rate this an 8, duplicitous extras. That's my rating.
Nice.
Is duplicitous a word?
Yeah.
Yes. It is, right?
Yeah.
Sounds like it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
And on that note, this was Umba.
This is Steve.
This is Ricky.
Bye.
Bye.
In a bit.
You're a superstar at the game. superstar.